So Pinchas is a striking personality, intervenes, saves the day, vigilante justice, doesn't ask questions, or at least according to the Gemara Sanhedrin, asks the questions, but acts where Beisdin is impaired from acting in the heat of the moment, staving off a raging apocalyptic plague that had decimated the Jewish camp. And in Parshas Pinchas, named for him, he receives his just reward. And when this personality is introduced, there's an extra layer. Normally, biblical personalities are introduced by their name, and if necessary, their parents' name. Pinchas, or all the Nesiim, Tzuriel ben Amit Tzuri Shaddai, Sisor ben Michael, Nachbi ben Bavsi, Nachshon ben Aminadab, Zal ben Uri, Aliyah ben Achisamach. Sometimes, they're traced one generation prior, and in the case of Pinchas, we sense that. Pinchas ben Elazar ben Aharon HaKohen. So why the tracing back to his grandfather Aharon? So Rashi suggests that Pinchas was a controversial figure, to say the least. The naysayers and the scoffers were looking for scandals and skeletons in his closet, and they found it two generations prior, because Pinchas' mother, Elazar's wife, was the daughter of Yisro. So Elazar was Yisro's son-in-law. Yisro marries one of Yisro's daughters, or his granddaughter, I forget the exact genealogy, but on his mother's side, his mother descended from Yisro. And the naysayers and the scoffers were saying, oh, this Pinchas, he looks like a hero, but really he stems from idolatrous stock, because his grandfather on his mother's side, again, I think it was literally his grandfather's, Pinchas' mother, Elazar's mother, was Yisro's daughter. He was busy sacrificing to idols and worshiping idols, and this was a way to deride or to diminish the appeal, the authority, the way people saw Pinchas. This is a way to break down his character. So to compensate, the Torah develops his paternal grandfather as Aharon HaKohen, reminding us that he stems from Aharon, that there's this other grandfather to offset whatever flaws may have existed on one paternal or one grandfatherly side. Rav Aharon, in his sicha, this is the sicha he delivered, when did he deliver it? 1997. In the sicha, Rav Aharon wanted to suggest a different approach. This is the Sirda Shlishit sicha. But to understand it, Rav Aharon had to first explore a different phrase pertaining Pinchas. And this is the phrase that describes the Brisi Shalom. His gift is the Bris Shalom. Now, why does he receive a Bris Shalom? And again, some want to say because not only will he be a Kohen, but his descendants will also be Kohanim. So it's an everlasting Bris. But Rashi, and Rashi already cites the Gemara in Zvachim, that Pinchas is a strange Kohen. Because normally, Kohanim are... They inherit their title. Kohen is hereditary. You can't be a Kohen if you don't inherit it genealogically. And if you are hereditarily aligned, you don't need to prove it or to acquire it. It's not a meritocracy. You don't have to achieve it. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu appoints the first group of Kohanim, the first group of five Kohanim, Aharon and his four sons. And then all their children and descendants are inherently Kohanim without having to earn it. The problem is Pinchas, Aaron's grandson, Elazar's son, gets caught in the middle. He's born after the appointment in the beginning of Bamidbar of the Kohanim. So he doesn't receive it hereditarily, because when he's born, Elazar, Aaron's son, is not yet a Kohen. But he isn't appointed, perhaps because he's too young when the appointment occurs, perhaps because he's that next generation rather than Aaron and his sons. This is a grandson. So Pinchas is really the only Kohen to ever earn Kehuna. He earns it by his act of valor, by his act of defending Am Yisrael, staving off the Chilul Hashem. So it's a bris, it's a covenant. Hashem delivers Kehuna to him directly. he is, in many respects, the most personal Kohen. He is the Kohen that isn't handed to him in a silver platter, isn't something which is built in. There's no aristocracy. There's no feeling of entitlement. He actually earns it. It's very personal. Now, I'm pausing here in Rav Aharon's Sicha to talk about how resonant this was in Rav Aharon's thought and writings, that Rav Aharon, for example, in the yeshiva, really avoided this hierarchy or pecking order or food chain that sometimes exists in yeshivos, that the alter bachrim, more seniority, have certain rights above the average younger bachrim. I must have heard this story countless times about Rav Lichtenstein as a youngster in Camp Morris, a summer camp up in the mountains in the Catskills in New York, a camp that's the affiliate with Chaim Berlin Yeshiva, where Rav Aharon attended as a high school student. And Rav Aharon was waiting very patiently play ping pong. And as his turn came, one of the Alter Bachers stepped in and very extravagantly and bombastically said, "Well, too bad that you waited. I'm an Alter Bacher. I'm an older boy. I have rights to the ping pong game." And Rav Aharon was so bristled at that and felt it was so vulgar and immoral. And was very careful in yeshiva not to award any privileges based on seniority. Everyone was even. And of course, this reflected his own life, and he never secured or pursued or solicited privileges based on his rank, based on his title. Very much a meritocracy, very much, I mean, and even, and I know that inevitably when people are listening to this, they're wondering how much of a meritocracy did Yeshivat Har Etzion become if Rav Aharon's son, Rav Moshe Lichtenstein, succeeded him as a Rosh Yeshiva, which in many ways reflects non-meritocracies, aristocracies, which are handed down. And so the truth is, as someone that was involved in that succession, remember there are two stages to the Yeshivat Har Etzion succession. There was the first stage launched around, I don't know the number, late 2s, 208, 209, 207 maybe, in which Rav Amital ceded his official title to two Rosh Yeshivas, currently Rav Meidan and Rav Baruch Gigi. And Rav Aharon continued to be the Rosh Yeshiva alongside those two. And then towards the end of his life, Rav Lichtenstein transferred or transitioned his Rosh Yeshiva to the person that would replace him, which eventually became Rav Moshe Lichtenstein. But this wasn't nepotism. This was very much a process of interviewing many candidates. I was interviewed, not as a candidate, but I was interviewed as part of the committee. The committee interviewed all the Rabbanim in the yeshiva, asking us to recommend candidates to succeed. Rav Lichtenstein, it was a very, very lively bunch of people, and various people were suggested whose last names were Lichtenstein. It just so happened that Rav Moshe Lichtenstein was chosen as the most qualified candidate. I remember, on a personal note, that when I decided to enter the world of Chinuch and Torah, which wasn't something I planned on, it wasn't something I was anticipating growing up, something I came to when I first came to the yeshiva, and it created a bit of a stir for my parents, who had envisioned me in a very different profession. And when I finally was able to explain to them and justify and assure them that this was a wise and a responsible choice, my father turned to me, and my father had lived in Baltimore and had lived in Brooklyn and places that there was more of a presence of a yeshivish Torah network. And something that a lot of people don't understand, I teach in a yeshiva, which is a public organization, namely, the Rebbeim don't run the show. We run the day-to-day operations, but we have to answer to a board, and the board is selected, and obviously representations of different groups and sectors, and I receive a salary, and I'm a paid employee of a publicly directed company or organization. In most, again, I'm not in that world, but in most yeshivish settings, the yeshiva is very much a family-run operation, and it's run by a particular person in his family, and he has the right to use the funds as he chooses, and he has the right to delegate the yeshiva to his son or his chosen successor, regardless of the merit of other candidates. my father turned to me and said, well, now that I understand you want to enter the Torah world, you have to think carefully about who you're going to marry and which family you'll marry into, because that's the way to receive a title and position. Again, I'm not part of that world, so I don't know where it is true, where it isn't true. I'm sure in some cases it's more rigid and only family members are handed opportunities, and in some places it's more of a meritocracy. But my father said, you have to now think about whom you marry. And I said, no, the yeshiva world that I'm part of, whether it's the Hester world, whether it's the YU world, it very much is a meritocracy, and it's handed down to people of more deserving, people who have earned it. Now, there's always a high overlap between family, last name, and deserving, even in a meritocracy. A, because it's likely, not always, but if you grew up in the house of a Torah personality, it's you have a leg up, and you're probably going to be more invested in Torah, or at least if you choose to study that course, and you may have relationships with the people in the yeshiva, because that's where you grow up. So there's a comfort level, and everything about hiring, even in a meritocracy like Microsoft or Google, it's relationships and comfort levels and security in relationships. So anyway, getting back to Rav Lichtenstein, it's very resonant that he spoke about Pinchas meriting his kahuna. The problem is as follows. When you receive your title as part of a meritocracy, aristocracy in a tradition, you very much feel beholden to those traditions. You're part of a larger system. You're part of a chain, of a lineage. So you're less apt to personalize. You're less apt to make change. But when you feel that you're elected or you're selected and you've merited, earned it on a personal basis of earning it, you're less apt to be faithful or loyal to the traditions. And you can feel that, well, you're your own person, you're an independent agent, and you can make decisions that in many ways depart or deviate strongly and glaringly from the tradition. And the rules that apply to previous Kohanim don't necessarily apply to you, if you're Pinchas. Which is why Rav Aaron felt the Torah traces Pinchas back to Elazar and ultimately back to Aaron to create that sense of intellectual lineage, even though it wasn't a title handed down through the lineage. That even though Pinchas earns his kahuna rather than being handed his kahuna, he still has to be dedicated and devoted and honest to the tradition, to the Masorah. He has to operate as if he were a Kohen hereditarily rather than meritocracy. And Rav Aaron quoted to us and it was always, of course, trying to broaden the fabric, and very obviously a certain small percentage of people in the room were Kohanim, so discussing this balance and this calibration for Kohanim would be a very limiting conversation. So he stretched it or extrapolated it to the world of Torah, because everyone in the room wanted to be a Talmud Chacham, wanted to study Torah, at least was in that track. And the Rambam talks about the Keser of Torah. There are three types of crowns, three forms of nobility that are available for Jews. One is the nobility of Kahuna, Keser, Kahuna. One is the nobility of Malchus, Keser, Malchus. And one is the nobility of Torah, Keser, Torah. The first two crowns are hereditary. You can't be a Kohen unless you have the right genes. You can't be a Melech unless you stem from Malchus Beis David. But Keser Torah is the ultimate meritocracy across the board. Not just every once in a while there'll be a Pinchas who achieves meritorious kahuna rather than hereditary kahuna. But Torah, Kol Rotzei Litol Yavo V'Yitel, the Rambam writes. But that sense of personal ownership and personal earning of Torah should still be tethered to following the Masorah and attending to the traditions rather than completely personalizing it. And again, this sicha is very reflective of Lichtenstein's balance between personalizing, creative, earning, internalizing, and reliability, loyalty, and affinity to the Masorah. It's very reflective of the calibration between two different poles in general, not just these two poles. So, it's also reflective of Rav Aaron being a very careful reader and Of course, you would always quote the Rashi, he quotes the Gemara in Zvachim, which Rashi is based on Kuf Yud Aleph, but he wasn't in any way inhibited from offering a very, very independent and very refreshing view of why the lineage of Pinchas was provided.